Thank you. deserve. Unfortunately, that barking wasn't a career, and I did think it was quite short-lived, so we still potentially have that to come.
Another moment of excitement to arrive.
Exactly. Okay. Yep, indeed. Hopefully that's all the excitement that happens here today. Sorry, I wasn't meaning in terms of this process, I was meaning in my
We'll take it as we hear it.
I'm going to now turn to Overseer, if I could, Mr. Chivilco, and I'd like to firstly acknowledge that it is very difficult, the role of being both a council employee and its witness in a process like this. But I am intrigued by some of the language in your evidence where you use I and my when you're referring to Overseer. So there's a number of examples that I can give you in your evidence in chief. If we start there, it went paragraphs 92. I consider that the overseer-based thresholds should not be used in the rules. Similarly, at 102, I do not consider that overseer should be used. 104, my view is that overseer should not be used.
Council, is this something where, if we were to alter that, to be a phrase along the lines of, in my opinion, based on what I've read, there'd be a problem? I just wonder whether this is going to assist us.
No, sir, I can jump to my question that was going to follow. What I was wanting to check, Mr. Trevalco, whether this was the council more broadly view or a decision that you have made, replan change one.
It is my opinion as a professional planner. That's why I'm expressing it in that point. I would make the point I've had a lot to do with Overseer.
We'll get to that.
Yes, all right.
We'll get to that, sorry.
Yes.
It's just earlier today you confirmed that it was your decision in consultation with the members of the implementation team to retain the farm plan provisions in PC1.
Yes.
I'm interested whether it was your decision to remove Overseer from Plan Change 1.
I would say it was my professional opinion to do so.
Yes, I accept it's your professional opinion to do so. I'm interested in whether the amendments to Plan Change 1 to remove Overseer is something that you have decided to do or council has decided to do.
Council hasn't been involved in that decision. I mean, there's been lots of conversation, of course, but at the end of the day, this is my recommendation as a planner.
Who was your recommendation made to?
In this case, to the court, I would say, sir.
Well, in terms of the instructions that have been given to the council for the regional council, are you instructing them, or is there another officer of the council instructing them, or is there a committee that you're reporting to? How does this work?
There has been a committee that we were reporting to, yes. I haven't explicitly had this conversation about whether Overseer should be used in PC1 with that body. I mean, council at the beginning of this process gave me the authority to make decisions on their behalf through this appeal process.
So that's a resolution of the council delegating authority to you under the Act.
I don't know. It was a letter or notification from the director.
I see. Is there going to be a challenge to the process, Ms. Carruthers, or are all things presumed to have been done according to the relevant requirements?
Well, to be fair, sir, that wasn't the answer I was expecting. I had anticipated there would have at least been a council resolution regarding the version of plan Phase 1 put to the court, but as I understand Mr. Trevelco's evidence, he's explained that this is his version of PC1 to the court for consideration.
Well, so that's my question. Is this to be pursued in terms of authority, or is, notwithstanding that there may have been correspondence with a senior officer and who knows what a trawl through the minutes of the council or one of its committees may reveal, are we going to proceed on the maxim that all things are presumed to have been done in the way in which they were meant to be done?
I'm not intending on challenging the process, sir.
Well, then, what we come back to is whether or not what we have in terms of the version, the post-conferencing version, I suppose, is what we've been calling it.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, who else has been involved in the decision-making process for the changes that are shown in the tracking of that version?
As I understand it, that's Mr. Trevelco's changes.
Again, sir, that's in consultation with a lot of staff at council.
Well, I understand the consultation point, Mr. Trevelco. I mean, the way the question was put to you and what I certainly heard in terms of my role in this process is who made the decision. And if the decision as to the version of the post-conferencing version of Plan Change 1 attached to council submissions was essentially the version that you said, yes, this is the version, or did another officer of the council say that is the version to be used by council, or did a committee say that, or did the full council say that?
It is my recommendation, sir, or my proposal.
So Plan Change 1, as we know, is introducing Chapter 311 into the Regional Plan. Chapter 310 of the Regional Plan for the Pōhoro catchment, I understand you have had involvement with that chapter previously as well.
Yes, I have.
And that chapter uses overseer at present.
That's right.
And Plan Change 2 corrected, or did the versioning correction along the lines of what Mr. Sinclair was referring to in his evidence?
Yes, we had to do a plan change to allow different versions to be used in Taupo to determine the nitrogen reference number that they use there.
And in Chapter 310, as I read it, the concept of nitrogen per hectare per year sets the activity status for farming in the Tōhoro catchment. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's done using overseer?
Yes, it is. It's quite a complex process now.
Yes. And that plan change, which I understand from your evidence in chief, Para 2, you led that plan change to update Chapter 310.
That's right.
No. And that plan change was notified in April 2020 and made operative in October 2020.
Sounds about right.
No. And so the plan change one appeals were filed in July 2020. That's during that plan change two process. Were you involved in the regional council's appeal on plan change one when it was filed in July 2020?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Were you familiar with that appeal when it was filed?
Not at the time, no.
Okay. So with Chapter 310, using overseer, is that going to be updated through the freshwater planning instrument process?
I don't know the answer to that at this stage. It's overseer kind of works in that context for a number of reasons. I don't know if it will remain in use. It's been a very, very successful process in Taupo in terms of managing farmers to cap nitrogen, which was what it was all about, to protect the lake. It works very well. There are only about 100 farms, large farms in that area, that need a nitrogen reference number. They've been involved politically through the process for many, many years. I understand that there's a lot of staff involvement with them to make this whole thing work. It wouldn't work with thousands of farms. The other big difference to me is that Taupo generally is free-draining soils, it's pumice soils, and one of the things that the Ministry has been telling us for about 3 years, I think, since the review of the overseer model, is that even when the model has been improved, it's likely to be only useful or only applicable for assessing leaching on properties with free draining soils. Now, I'm not sure if that's their latest advice, but that was consistent advice over a number of years through a number of different reports that I've read. Now, that kind of works in Taupo because they are free draining soils. Overseer is more accurate there, it seems, for free draining soils. And that's simply because Overseer talks about nitrogen leaching, and on free-draining soils, most of the nitrogen that gets away through the land is through leaching as opposed to overland flow. So that's why it kind of works better in those Taupo soils.
But it's used in a way to set activity status, isn't it, in Chapter 310?
To be honest, I have to go back and look at the rules again to check that, but I think you're right. But it's certainly used for the way that farming is managed. So all those farmers have a nitrogen reference point based on overseer, and they need to farm within that nitrogen cap. Each farm has a cap.
And the activity says the farm depends on the overseer number.
I'd have to check the rules. I'm sorry, I don't remember that aspect right now.
Okay. But in any event, if Plan Change 1 was made operative with Overseer, it would not be the only catchment using Overseer in the regional plan.
No, that's right. But like I say, I think there are very good reasons why it's still used in Taupo. I don't see that as applicable in the rest of the region.
You don't. Okay.
Well, from all that, all the discussions I've been part of, and there's been many, and I've worked very, very closely with John Palmer, who's our overseer expert, who is one of the country's overseer experts. We worked as a duo on that whole plan change to make that thing work. So we've had many, many conversations about the use of overseer. So yes, it's my opinion, reasonably well informed, it's my opinion as a planner.
Okay. And the freshwater planning instrument to be notified next year may or may not amend the use of overseer in Chapter 310.
That's right.
Okay. So if we were to retain overseer and the decisions version of the gateways, then we'd have the dry stock gateway and then all other farming being assessed through one. So not just dairy, but also pigs, poultry, orchards, winter grazing, all of the things that fall into the farming definition that don't necessarily fall into the dairy and dry stock definitions.
It may be the case. I mean, the problem I would have is I've been working on this on my view that overseer shouldn't be the basis of thresholds mm-hmm. for a long time now, and so the various versions and decisions that I've made on various points about the rules over time now have come from that position. So the rules have been written now, in my version of it, based on not using overseer. So it's become a different thresholds for dry stock and dairy farming, whereas cropping, for example, would have used overseer as part of its decision making about which rule it fits. We've now written things differently, so you don't need to do it with overseer. So if overseer was reinstalled, or if overseer survived the process, there would probably be a number of other changes that would be needed to my recommendations in terms of proposed changes, if that makes sense.
Okay. And when preparing your version, did you turn your mind to the types of farming activities that would fall through the crack if we just focus on dry stock and dairy?
Yes, I did. And I've asked that question of a number of our people. So based on those conversations that I've had with people, my understanding is there aren't other activities that would fall through the cracks. So you have dairy farming, you have dry stock farming, which covers any other, and based on the definition, any other animal pastoral farming. And then you have arable cropping, and of course CVP is separate. I'm not aware of anything that's not covered by all of that. I stand corrected if there is something, but that's what I understand.
Okay, right. What about pigs?
They would be part of dry stock.
Okay.
Well, again, that's my understanding. I may be wrong. And, you know, if there is something that falls through the cracks, then yes, I think we would need to find a way of dealing with that.
So, pigs. Poultry. Llamas. Orchards. All of these things are caught under the decision version by capturing all other farming, dry stock and all other farming.
Yes, so you may be right about that, in which case we would need to do a bit more thinking about that.
And so by we, you mean the court?
Well, in terms of any further recommendations or proposals I might make through council, I'd need to think about that.
Okay.
Well, I think the point that Ms. Corrales was hinting at, Mr. Trevilco, is that the court is now in charge of the appeals against decisions made by the council through its commissioners on submissions on Plan Change 1.
having commenced the hearing of those, we have to proceed now and reach a conclusion on those appeals. Now, if the council is considering changing its position at this stage in terms of what it says should be in our decision on the appeals, it will need to get cracking, because after you, I think there's one other witness, and then we'd be expecting the council to close its case unless we look at some other process.
Yes, sir.
So I just think that there may need to be some consideration, and once you've finished your evidence, there may need to be some discussion about what the council's position is.
Yes, sir.
I would expect that the other parties will want to know that, because in the nature of this process, which I'm sure you appreciate, for better or worse, is an adversarial process, the council, as the proponent of Plan Change 1, needs to set out its case so that the others can respond to it.
Yes, sir.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honour. So, I won't get down into the weeds of the definitions and the difficulties that I see in them at present and how they may or may not work with your rule structure. I want to raise up above that. Loosely speaking, we're looking for a way that the best farms are permitted activities, most farms are controlled activities, and the poorest performing dairy farms are restricted discretionary activities. Sort of the approach we're trying to find in this rule structure. I understand that at least correctly.
Yeah, I might not describe it that way, I understand what you're saying. I might not describe it in those words.
Right, so maybe if you could describe to me then what you're trying to capture in permitted, controlled, and restricted discretionary. If it's not the best, most in the core performance.
I would describe it in terms of, in the way that I think Policy 2 describes it, it's about the level of risk of diffuse discharges to water bodies. That's the way I would describe it.
Okay, so the lowest risk, you might not call them the best farms, but the lowest risk is permitted.
Yes.
The moderate risk is controlled, and the highest risk is RDA.
Yes, that's right.
But for all of those, they need to meet the Schedule C minimum standards and all have a farm plan.
Yes. I mean, there's a couple of conditions around that, of course, but yes, generally.
Sure. Yeah. Now, Mr. Broksop's evidence earlier in the week, his expectation is that if you meet the minimum standards and you have a farm plan under either Schedule D1 or D2, that you'll be granted consent. Is that where you're coming from as well with your expectation?
Well, I wouldn't, as a planner, I wouldn't describe it in those terms. I would say the consent has conditions, so do you fit within those conditions? Which rule do you fit into? And then the normal RMA decision-making process would occur.
Okay. So given they have to meet this minimum standards and they have to have a farm plan, conceptually, the difference between the three risk levels is that the highest risk farms need to do a Schedule D2 farm plan, which is the goals and principles farm plan.
The moderate and high, if we're using those terms, need to do a Schedule D2.
Yes, of course. So both the controlled activity and RDA activity both have a Schedule D2 farm plan.
That's right.
So what? So just remind me your rationale for having a different activity status then between those two.
Between controlled and restricted discretionary?
Yeah.
I kind of see it in terms of policy two. Getting the wrong policy two. There are different expectations for moderate farming versus high-risk farming. And
in terms of the extent option.
Yeah, that's right. So for moderate farming under policy two, and that's under policy 2B2, they're required to effectively demonstrate that the risk of diffuse discharges is as low as practicable, or will be as low as practicable. For the higher risk farms, that's in policy 2BC, they need to reduce that risk. That's a bigger ask, a more complex thing. Could even involve the need for land use change.
Sure.
So I don't think controlled activity is the right process for that. I think it needs to be a bit more of a complex look at the whole thing. How do you do it? How do you achieve that?
Because if the farm plan doesn't sufficiently demonstrate it, then there's a risk of decline.
Exactly.
To incentivize land use change. Okay.
Well, that's right. We're hoping that's not going to be a common thing, but yes, it's possible.
And then with the rule thresholds, and if we use the nitrogen risk scorecard instead, as you note in paragraph 94 of your evidence in chief, you're hoping to capture the same number of farms.
Yes, that's right.
But as I understand it, we've got no evidence that it would be the same farms. It's just the same number of farms to go through that more rigorous assessment.
Yes.
And in terms of whether we're capturing the right farms or not, you rely on Fonterra's analysis and evidence.
The Fonterra risk scorecard was the one most favoured by the experts when they had their conferencing about alternatives to overseer.
But in terms of whether the risk scorecard is capturing the right farms, you're confident it will still be the same number of farms. You don't know if it's the same farms still.
That's right.
But whether it's the right farms being captured, you're relying on Fonterra's evidence there rather than providing your own.
I don't think I'm only relying on Fonterra's evidence. I think I'm relying on Mr. Boxoff's evidence as well. I mean, I accept that overseer in the right place is a better tool for determining risk because it takes into account the geological soils, drainage, climate matters that the scorecard doesn't, but I still think that the scorecard itself is a reasonable gateway tool, as you say, that will give us a reasonable assessment, enough to get into the three levels of risk, I guess, to identify that. none of this is perfect by a long, long way in any of the tools we've got. But if we can't use overseer, and I still understand that we can't, then it is Fonterra's tool as the only viable current alternative we have.
And I don't think I'll go through the rules in detail, but if I can just check your understanding of what you're trying to do with the notes you've suggested below the heading 3.11.4.
Yes.
So we can only have one milking platform per property, and there's other restrictions on how you capture a single operating unit. So you're a relatively small unit. You're suggesting that for each property, it gets each and every consent it triggers in these rules when there are multiple land uses on the property. So a dry stock consent if you need one, a dairy consent if you need one, a discretionary activity, other farming consent if you need one. Is that what you're suggesting in your notes?
Well, the rules are the rules, and you might need a controlled activity consent for a farm or single operating unit that has both dry stock and dairy on it. So
yeah,
where they both get triggered into a controlled activity rule. So you don't necessarily need a separate dry stock consent and dairy consent if they both trigger the controlled activity rule.
If they're both in the controlled.
Yeah.
Yes. But if on your farm you have dry stock, dairy, arable cropping, and something else, you'll need to identify under for each of those activities whether you're permitted or something else.
Yes.
And apply for all of them.
If you need different consents, you need to apply for more, yes.
Right. And then you're suggesting you may have one farm environment plan for your property.
Yes, you may do.
Okay. Your preference for Wairākei Estate is, let's say, 30 properties with the potential for multiple consents on each property and 30 farm plans.
That's possibly the case. I mean, it's not to say that that's 30 processes, but so you might even have one comprehensive consent process for all of Wairākei Farm or Pastoral's farming activities, and you would be allocated different consents for different activities. Some of them will have similar conditions, but they'll all probably have a different consent number for each property or single operating unit. That's the way I would see that.
Okay.
There are not many situations I'm aware of that are as complex as Wairaka Pastoral. So, you know, I understand the concern of having to have lots of consents, but that doesn't make me feel that we've got the rules wrong that would cover off most farming situations in an efficient way.
Okay, well, if we think of a smaller farming operator who still has dry stock, dairy, arable cropping, and fits under three different rules in here, seen as their land use rules, would each consent then need to be tied to the particular habits for that use?
I don't think that's necessary in any kind of legal sense.
So you would read the rules as allowing a land use consent over the entire farm for dry stock, a land use consent over the entire farm for dairy, and a land use consent over the entire farm for cropping. Is that how you see it?
You may end up in that situation, yes.
Right. Okay. And that's what you're anticipating?
In some cases, I expect that would be the case.
Finally then, if we turn to purchase in surplus and the questions that I asked earlier in the week, my understanding of your rebuttal evidence at paragraph 350 is that most farms are below the limit, so we'll retain it.
My understanding is that purchased nitrogen surplus is a reasonable indicator of the amount of nitrogen that kind of stays on the farm year to year, if you like. It seems to be have some indication of the kind of levels of leaching that may occur, in the sense that if you've got high purchased nitrogen surplus, then you're likely to have a higher nitrogen leaching rate. And that was my understanding from the graphs that were shown in the Farm Systems JWS, that there seemed to be quite a good relationship there between modelled leaching in that case, anyway. I think it was measured leaching, actually, and the purchased nitrogen surplus. So that, of course, that came after I'd been recommending its use anyway. It just seemed to be a statistic that is used commonly by the industry and by regulators. And again, this is just from various conversations I've had with people over the years. To me, it's still a useful statistic. It's commonly used and reported to farmers. So, you know,
the dairy farmers.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And so the note to the standard suggests that the council has an online calculator, which isn't the case as yet.
I don't think we're there yet, yes, but it's a very, very simple calculation. And, I mean, our aim is going to be to have a portal that allows farmers to calculate their nitrogen risk scorecard value. It would be
dry stock farmers.
That's for dairy farmers. some of the dairy farmers at least that that they could use probably, I'm not sure if it kicks out the same statistic, but it'd be very, very simple to use that portal to determine that the purchased nitrogen surplus as well.
Okay, but this is a standard that dry stock farmers have to demonstrate compliance with.
Yeah, that's right. So we need we need to have a standalone calculator for that. It shouldn't be difficult.
Right, but it's not available yet.
I don't believe so.
Okay. And the notes suggest that the calculation's done after the farm plan is implemented rather than prior.
Just point me to the words again that says it.
Yeah, so it's in Schedule D1, the standard is.
Yes, I've got it now, and I haven't read that very much, that clause. I don't know why it says it needs to be done afterwards, I'm sorry. That's been sitting there since the decision version.
I see. Do you agree that for a standard where you need to demonstrate compliance in advance, do you agree that for standards you need to be able to demonstrate compliance?
Yes.
At the relevant time?
Yes.
And that this doesn't do that?
It doesn't, and I don't understand why it doesn't. There's been no appeals about that I'm aware of anyway, in terms of those words. I haven't done anything because it's not being brought to my attention as an issue I need to address.
Okay, Wairakei Pastoral Appeal seeks to delete the standard.
Yes.
You've responded to that in your rebuttal, paragraph 350.
Yes.
Did you not turn your mind to the note?
No, I didn't at the time. It was the standard I was interested in.
Thank you. I've got no further questions, Your Honour. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Forrett, I assume
is Ms. Forrett online? All right, if you would. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Trebelco, and happy birthday.
Good afternoon, and thank you.
Any happy return.
yesterday, when you were having a discussion with Mr. Matheson, you talked about the focus of Climate Change One on meeting the 10-year target. But of course, as per Objective One, you will acknowledge that we have to have confidence through Climate Change One that we're going to achieve the 80-year target as well. And so I want to talk to you about what Climate Change One might achieve versus a climate change that's coming in the future.
Yes.
And in order to do that, I wanted to take a step back and talk about how we manage cumulative effects, because there's been a lot written on that in planning circles, and that in order to manage cumulative effects, which includes, of course, diffuse discharges from numerous farms, you need the preferences for a limits-based approach, isn't it?
Yes.
And this council is familiar with a limit-based approach because one is used in Opal and, of course, Variation 6 for water allocation limits.
Yes.
And what's your view of whether PC1 takes a limits-based approach to managing these diffuse discharges?
Well, it doesn't have a problem. so we have limits that we're seeking to achieve, yes, but that's at the sub-catchment level, not the property level. Not quite sure if that's what you're asking.
Well, yes, that was what I'm asking. So you haven't attempted to allocate limits back on a per farm basis through a tool such as Overseer.
Well, that was the notified version was using that approach, which for the reasons in the decision report, and I don't quote them, they changed that approach.
Yes, alright.
It was, I think, a concern about the idea of grandparenting using that kind of approach.
Yes. So, even on a sub-catchment basis, and we have the tables with various target attribute states in the back of PC1.
Yes.
What's the connection between the farm environment plan requirements and the target attribute states, even at a sub-catchment basis?
Well, trying to figure out the best way of answering that question. The farm environment plan approach and the expectations of the policy directions is to generally reduce discharges of the four contaminants. And there are a lot of provisions to support that approach, including the farm environment plan approach. There is definitely an expectation, and I think it's expressed in a number of places in PC1, that farms are all working towards reducing their contaminants. So that's the approach. We can't quantify it. We don't have the models to do that right now.
You can't quantify it, and you're attempting through a new method, which relies on the CCCV plus some additional requirements to provide that as information to the farm environment plan certifiers, aren't you? The target attribute states requirements for each sub-catchment.
Yes, that's right.
And Mr. McAuliffe, in his evidence on Monday, at his paragraph 48, just for reference, but he went through all the requirements that the council would need to do for the freshwater planning review, and we'll call that the 2024 plan change.
Yes.
And there are numerous of them, aren't there?
Yes.
And do you anticipate that for that purpose and for full compliance with the NPSFM 2020, you will need to have a closer relationship between target attribute states and what is required by farmers at the sub-catchment levels?
What do you mean by closer relationship?
So the relationship at the moment is you provide the information through the CCCV, and as I understand it, the policy framework includes that for moderate farms you reduce to as low as practicable over an appropriate specified period. And so that CCCV would inform that, but there's also a practicability assessment.
Yes.
And my reading of the NPSFM 2020, and maybe different to your reading, is that there would need to be more certainty that farms at the sub-catchment level are going to be working towards achieving a particular target attribute state.
Yes, I'm just not sure how you would provide that certainty. You know, I don't see any way you can, at the moment, provide that certainty.
because of?
Because we don't have science that can align the activities that are occurring on the farm with the downstream water quality. We don't have the science that connects those two things.
And a large part of that is your view in relation to the overseer tool?
Overseer gave us some really good information, and in the right soils can tell us a lot about leaching of nitrogen. It doesn't tell us how much actual nitrogen gets to the water bodies, but it can tell us about leaching. So it gave us good information, and I think calculations could be done at the catchment level using Overseer. Even now, that would be useful to give some indication at the catchment level of what kind of changes might be occurring and impacts on water, but it's pretty loose still.
Have you considered the comparative resource consenting process that's now provided for particular groups of consents under the NBEA?
No, I haven't.
All right. Can I refer you, please, to your rebuttal evidence at paragraph 145?
Yes.
And I'm wishing to turn to the issue with policy 7 and the proposed 15-year maximum consent term.
Yes.
And you state there that parties have requested a wide range of changes to policy 7.
Yes.
You've changed the term from a set period ending 2035 to a requirement that the term does not generally exceed 15 years. Supported by Ms. Dines for Wairarapi Pastoral, not by Ms. Ma for Fish and Game, and Ms. Ma thinks that the word generally is removed from the policy and is amended so that the term is no longer than 10 years.
Yes.
And then you go on to say in the last two sentences that a term of 10 years would not enable, well, you can let me know whether this is the correct paraphrasing, but would not enable the Regional Council to grant consents under PC1 that would last until the plan change after the 2024 plan change.
Yes, that's right. Just simply because of the amount of time it takes to do a plan change.
But yesterday you did answer a question from Mr. Matheson on this. The NPSFM plan change process requires 2 years from notification, and so I think you said you'd expect the NPSFM plan change to be enforced by 2027.
Yes, thereabouts. But it's a new process. I don't actually know how that's going to turn out.
Well, what I wanted to get to was if the Regional Council is able to grant consents so that they do not have to re-consent people under the 2024 plan change within the scope of PC1.
Yeah.
You would really wonder what the point of the 2024 plan change is, or the Waipae and Waikato catchment.
Sorry, I didn't understand that.
If you're granting consent to applicants under PC1, and you wish to grant a term of 15 years to provide flexibility for the Regional Council not to have to re-consent them to the plan change after the 2024 plan change.
Yes.
What's the point of the 2024 plan change for those catchments?
Well, I mean, we need to do the 2024 plan change, don't we? So I'm not quite sure why you're asking what's the point of the plain feet.
If you have a moving regulatory environment and the government has imposed, of course, changes to the NPSFN, including additional attribute states.
Yes.
And I went through with Mr. Scar's book a number of issues for fish and game to do with lakes, attribute states for lakes.
Yes.
Shouldn't you be looking to grant a shorter term for consents rather than a longer term?
In preparation for other changes, you mean?
Yes. Yeah.
No, I don't think so, because we don't know what those changes might be or when they might happen, so I don't think we can use that as the basis for consent terms, in my view. I mean, when I think about these terms, and you would have heard Mr. Sinclair talk about, well, you know, 10 years for a plan to be operative, 5 years to change it, so therefore 15 was his calculation, therefore a 15-year term. And another way that could be calculated, when I think about it, so if the freshwater plan change was completed in, let me say, 2026, 10-year life, 2036, let's say 4 years for a new plan change, 2040, before we have a new plan change. So if we start granting consents in 2025 for this plan change, for PC1, 15 years takes you to 2040. So it's, you know, from that kind of rough calculation as well, 15 years kind of seems appropriate as any other date, if you like, any other term. But, you know, we can calculate this so many different ways, but what I do think is that we're unlikely to have another plan change after the 2024 one within 10 year period. So if you're granting 10-year consents, you're going to end up having to grant other consents again, also under that current plan change, before we do the next 2040 plan change, or whatever it might be.
Well,
but it's all crystal balls.
No, thank you. It is. I think we may be talking at cross purposes, so I'll just finish off by asking you, shouldn't we be looking to reconsent farms under the 2024 plan change, given the very large program of work that the Regional Council's got and the number of things that the Regional Council has to do to fill in the gaps with the NPSFN, like some other councils are looking to do with their terms of consent? And I'll just, for example, Greater Wellington has a cut-off period of 31 December 2032 to allow for that 2024 plan change to come into effect. Are we talking at cross purposes? Or
Every time I think about this, it just seems 15 years gives us about the right length of time from when we first start granting consents to hopefully have another plan change in place before those 15-year consents need to be redone.
All right, thank you. So if I can take you back to policy 2. And what Fish and Game seems to be some limitations with this plan change, and the planner has recommended some tightening up, if you like. So in policy 2, capital B, sub B, the policy direction is to reduce diffuse discharges to water as low as practicable over an appropriate specified period. And the word practicable takes into account cost factors for an individual farmer.
Yes.
And then if we go over to the definition over the page of appropriate specified period,
yes.
And D2, there are a list of matters that you consider when determining the period over which, and I understand it's the period over which the farmer would be required to implement farm environment plan actions.
Yes.
And so there you've got the intention to achieve the interim target attribute states within 10 years is one of a number of factors.
Yes.
And the other factors include whether it's reasonably practicable to implement, the cost of the actions and mitigations relative to the scale of the farming business and the appropriateness of spreading the costs over time.
Yes.
And as you know, Ms. Ma's opinion is that the intention to achieve the interim target attribute state should be elevated and not be one of a list of a number of factors. And that you should consider certainly the spreading of costs over time relative to the size of the farming business, but that these other matters weaken the policy direction. How are you going to manage farms on a case-by-case basis for farmers stating that it's too expensive to implement within 10 years? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, it's a complex, it will be a complex call, and you know, this is one of those situations again where there needs to be some really good conversations with farmers about what's possible and what's not in any particular case. In saying we know we need to meet the table, but as I've said before, we need to meet the 10-year targets, but we can't say what that particular farm is doing in terms of those targets and what it needs to do to achieve them. So it's a very broad thing I would have said, where you could possibly say if the farm, if the sub-catchment that the farm is in is a long way from those targets, then you might put a lot more pressure on that farm to do something different to improve or reduce diffuse discharges. But you know, these are complex conversations that will take into account what the farmer's doing currently, what they've been doing in the past, how much, you know, what kind of risk is on that particular farm, what are the options for addressing it. There are so many things to consider here, so, and all of those need to be considered. It's a difficult conversation.
What about the cost factor? I mean, will you be requiring farmers to provide balance sheets and things to verify whether they can afford to?
No, not at all. But I mean, we always, when we're granting consents, think about the costs of whatever it is that we're granting. You know, if we're talking about something that could be millions of dollars, well, you know, we may not be able to expect that to be happening within the first couple of years. So it's at that level of taking that into account. And like I say, we always do this with all consents anyway. We have to take that into account. Otherwise, no point in granting a consent that's just not practical in terms of implementing it.
Is there a cut-off period if a farmer, for example, says, oh, I can't do that for 30 years? Well, I can't do that.
Well, if there is something like that, then we would need to put other things in place in the interim to at least try and get some of the way there. Again, these are complex conversations.
You appreciate that the concern for Fish and Game is that the policy direction is what's practicable over a practicable period.
Yes.
Which allows a lot of judgment on a case-by-case basis.
Sure.
With the lack of certainty over whether the 10-year targets are going to be achieved without further directive
yes.
policy. But you consider you've struck the balance right.
Well, I think it is about right, yes. I understand the concern, and if we had the, you know, if we had the tools and we had the understanding, a much better understanding of this thing here is going to affect the water downstream like this, it might be different. But sitting where we are right now, and to be honest, you know, everything that sits behind everything I think about for Plan Change 1 is, it's. I can't think too much about, well, if we make these farms do this stuff, we're going to achieve this. But what I think about is, this is the first significant management of farming in the Waikato. What's the best we can do right now? What's the most we can expect from farmers in terms of getting improvement and really getting it going and doing something that is going to work towards meeting those targets? And I'm thinking more along those lines, always have done, through this, because I just don't know the causality between actions and water quality. And in that sense, I think PC1 is pretty good in my view. I think it's pushing farmers as hard as we can practically push them right now. That's my overall feel for the whole thing. And I know that's not good enough in terms of, well, are we going to make it or not? But, you know, I see lots of potential for improvement. I think we're pushing it as hard as we can. The modelling tells us stuff, you know, that it's likely that most targets can be achieved. So, yeah, my policy brain just kind of tries to pull that together and say, well, I think this is the best we can do right now.
All right, thank you, Mr. Trebelko. I will turn to another topic which also revolves around what Fish and Game sees, some of the limitations with this particular plan change. And I went through with Mr. Scarsbrook the need in the future to comply with policy 13, but the policy in the NPSFN that requires the management of nitrogen phosphorus so as to achieve what's needed at the most sensitive downstream water bodies. And,
yes.
And you understand that work has to be done.
Yes.
And also the work that has to be done with regards to achieving ecosystem health targets for nutrients and the tributaries, not just toxicity and DRP at the bottom line.
Yes.
And in addition, Fish and Game was requesting a number of other additional attribute states be added to the tables in PC1, but have dropped all those requests pending the 2024 plan change process, except a request for dissolved oxygen in the Lower Waikato FMU.
Yes.
And Mr. Klee has also requested in his evidence and provided a table of how you could show current state for lakes in 31 lakes.
Yes.
And that would enable you to have measurement as to whether you're maintaining lakes according to a clear table in the plan which sets out current state for 31 lakes. And Mr. Scarsbrook, at his rebuttal, paragraph 47 at 301.0128, has said that yes, that's technically possible to include that table setting the current state for lakes in the plan, but your opinion is it shouldn't be included?
I'm not sure that I've said that. I may have done.
Apologies.
I don't necessarily have a problem including current state for DO in lakes, I don't think.
I'm sorry, I may have gone too fast. It's not the DO, it's number of attributes, phytoplankton, total nitrogen, total phosphorus, ammonia, cyanobacteria, and E. coli, relates, that you can assess what current status on the basis of the current monitoring information.
Yeah. What are you asking me? I'm sorry.
If the technical experts agree that you can put a table in PC1 to show current state for late with those attributes in it, would you have a problem with including that?
I don't really see a benefit in including that. What would be the benefit of including that?
The benefit would be to show people reading the plan without having to go to the council to ask for the information, what the current state of lakes is, what maintaining that state would mean.
Well, that's the question that starts to bother me, I guess.
Mm.
If you're saying that the table should be put in there with an expectation or a policy direction that those are maintained, that's a different story to me. That starts to talk about, well, how is that maintained? Is it possible? What has to be done to maintain it? And so on. So that becomes a problem to me. So in terms of just information for people, that can be done on our website, and it probably is anyway, but that's why I say I don't see the benefit of just putting current states in the plan.
Well,
maybe, but I don't see it at the moment.
Okay, well, just breaking that down a bit. Maintain is a requirement in Section 30 of the Act, isn't it? To maintain water quality is a requirement of a function of regional councils,
in
Section 30 of the Act.
Yes.
And it's a requirement of the National Policy Statement on fresh water.
Yes.
And so when you're setting an objective, you look at the objective against the Act and the higher level policy documents, don't you?
Yes.
And so there should be, if there isn't really an objective in this plan to maintain the quality of lakes, the water quality of lakes.
Well, there isn't an objective saying that at the moment.
And you have a problem with such an objective?
Yes, certainly. If there's a new objective saying maintain the current quality of lakes, it would certainly concern me without having some assessment of what does that mean in terms of how we manage the land around those lakes. And I don't think we've done that assessment.
Cost-benefit assessment under Section 32 of the Act requires an examination of whether provisions in the proposal are the most appropriate way to achieve objectives by identifying other reasonably practical options for achieving objectives, assessing efficiency and effectiveness at a level of detail that corresponds to the scale and significance of the environment.
Yes.
Mr. Nathan discussed with you yesterday.
Yes.
But the objectives themselves are, you examine the extent to which the objectives of the proposal are the most appropriate way to achieve the purpose of the Act.
Yes.
So to place an objective in a plan, you don't need to do a cost-benefit analysis.
Well, that's true, but there's no point in adding objectives without having policies and methods to achieve the achievements?
If there are no policies and methods to achieve, say, the objective of maintaining the water quality in lakes, because in Plan Change 1, what's relied upon substantially are the catchment plans for lakes.
Yes.
Okay. That would have to be added in the 2024 Plan Change.
An objective to maintain the quality of lakes?
Yes, and methods and
provisions
in order to.
Yes, I think so.
And so you could include the objective through a table that sets out clearly what maintain means for these 31 lakes. And then in 2024, you could add to your non-regulatory tolls to ensure that that objective is achieved.
I don't think we would want to add an objective. Like I say, you could add a table of baseline states, although I don't see the point in it. But if you're saying add an objective and we'll put the policies and methods in place later, that doesn't make good planning sense to me.
All right, thank you. The urgency with regards to the 10-year time frame takes on importance with water bodies that are potentially subject to irreversible changes, and I'm referring here to the Whangamurino wetland and lakes.
Yes.
And the Whangamurino wetland is influenced by nutrient and sediment inputs that are very largely influenced by the hydrological regime.
Yes.
Due to the Lower Waikato Waipa flood scheme. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so.
And the values that make the Whangamurino wetland outstanding and indeed have meant that it is now an internationally Ramsar recognised wetland includes the Restia of ecosystems, and excuse me if I'm not pronouncing that word correctly, but it relates to the type of vegetation found in those bog ecosystems.
Yes.
And the inputs of nutrients and sediment is creating vegetation changes throughout that bog ecosystem habitat.
Yes.
And Mr. Klee's evidence discusses this. And he points out, it is paragraph 6.11 and 6.12, the discussion in the section 32 report for PC1, that without careful management, the full range of wetland types present in the Whangamurino will continue to degrade with the potential loss of the bog ecosystems in particular. And at 6.1.2, quoting from the section 32 report, without significant management, this area will continue to degrade and potentially the values that make it internationally significant could be lost. So the PC1 does include target attribute states for the Whangamurino wetland for
yes.
Nutrients and sediment and phosphorus.
Yes.
But it hasn't been back calculated, as I discussed with Dr. Scarsbrook. My understanding, it hasn't been back calculated so that the subcatchments for the rivers and streams entering into the Whangamurino would necessarily meet that.
That's right.
And the Whangamurino, as well as lakes, are the first first priority is in Table 3.11.2, so that their consents for EPPs will be first off the block, if you like.
Yes.
So firstly, with the request for an FMU for the Whangamaruna wetland, can you outline, given the challenges that we have with this wetland and the multifaceted approach, that is not going to have to be needed to address the issue, what your opinion is regarding the Whangamaruna having its own FMU?
I mean, yes, I've said this a number of times in my evidence. I don't have a problem with the Whangamaruna being an FMU overall, in general. I just don't, I don't believe it's the right way to use the FMU concept by just calling it an FMU, and that's that. As I've said in response to Ms. Tumai's questions yesterday, an FMU to me is the beginning part of a NOC process established in consultational community, and then becomes the basis for objectives and total attribute states and so on. So I don't see the benefit in through PC1 just saying, well, the Whangamaruna is an FMU. I don't see the point in it. As I said yesterday, an FMU is not an indication of status of anything. It's just a management unit.
You do agree, though, don't you, that there's a difference between the needs of the Lower Waikato FMU and the Whangamaruna?
Yes, probably, yes.
And so, at what Fish and Game has been involved in this process for a very extensive period of time, at what point would a party need to raise its hand and say, we consider this should be an FMU? During your initial collaboration?
Yeah, I mean, ideally it happens at the time that council's going through that plan-making process.
And Mr. McAuliffe's evidence, I think he said that upon officer's recommendation, the council was not going to reconsider FMUs in the 2024 plan change for these Waipara and Waikato.
Yes, I heard that.
Yeah. What can, does that remain your recommendation?
It's not my recommendation. I'm not involved in that process.
And so what's your opinion then on whether this should be re-looked at in the 2024 plan change process?
I don't know if I've got... If it's my place to say that, I'm not one of the people involved in that process. I don't know what their reasons are for not considering or thinking about whether Whangamaruna should be its own FMU.
Okay, so you would, however, be relatively familiar with the NPSFM, though?
Relatively.
And Ms. Maher's gone into quite some detail about guidance around creating FMUs and what the sort of FMU spatial unit provides. And under the NPSFM, it requires a focus on that particular area.
Yeah.
And you look at, in addition to the compulsory values in the NPSFM, whether there are other values such as natural form and character, or other cultural values such as Waitapu, you look at that spatial scale.
Yes, I mean, I'm personally not against the idea of the Whangamaruna being its own FMU for a NOC process, but I'm not involved in that process, and I haven't been asked to give my opinion. I would still say, you know, you are part, Fish and Game and Doc are part of that process, and, you know, you need to be saying through that process exactly what you're saying to us, that it should be. And that's what the whole consultation engagement part of that is about, and submissions and all the rest of it. Like, I can't speak for them. I'm not doing that plan change.
And so your Fish and Game's also requested EPNU status for individual lakes or clusters of lakes where you can cluster them together, such as the Horsham Downs Lake Complex.
Yes.
And so your answer is presumably the same, that you need to get involved at the beginning of the process. You can't impose those at the end of the process.
That's right.
So I want to talk about the signals that are given to landowners, because I think over the last few days, and you've said this morning, that Plan Change 1 is only the start of a process.
Yes.
And Mr. Scarsbrook's evidence was that mitigations on farm will achieve only so much. And so you would agree, wouldn't you, that farmers need to know the scale of the challenge ahead after these consents, or during this consent process?
Yes, I think that's probably helpful for them to know that the scale of the issue that we're trying to address.
And I think it's dealt with in a method. I'll come back to that. So one of the other signals for farmers, and you talked about this yesterday with Ms. Toomai, is a signal in the policy relating to the whangamorino that hydrology needs to be managed as well as water quality per se.
Like I explained yesterday, my reading of the reference to hydrological drivers is saying we need to do these things, but we have to accept that hydrological drivers are impacting on the whangamorino, and we have to address those. It doesn't actually say that. It says that we will do what we can to achieve those things, but we know that there are hydrological drivers that, in addition, will have to be addressed.
And that's Objective 5.
Objective 5?
Yeah.
All right, what's that, a question?
I'll just get the wording of Fish and Game's request. Yes, so Fish and Game is wanting the words to be included there after the list of contaminants, including the hydrological drivers of the transport and deposition of those contaminants, so that it's flagged there on the objective.
Yes.
And your answer yesterday was that you didn't want to include those issues without having the methods.
That's right.
Thank you. Now, setbacks. Ethan Lamb and Federated Farmers are requesting the average of 3 metres setbacks, which you entered into a lengthy discussion with Mr. Matheson yesterday.
Yes.
And you held firm in your view that the 3 metres should be a minimum.
Yes.
Had you turned your mind, because it wasn't raised by Mr. Matheson, that if you had an average, that might be quite difficult from an enforceability perspective. It would be signed off, I understand, by a farm certifier. But how would you assess the average has been undertaken, and wouldn't you need to assess it after the fence had already been put in?
I agree, if the requirement was for an average, that would be much harder from a regulatory point of view to know whether it is in fact an average of 3 or whatever, or 1. Yes, I agree, and we have thought about that.
In the plan, setbacks are the policy regime for setbacks is around stopping stock entering the waterway and around the stomping on the banks, if I can put it that way, and that's in policy 2.
Yes.
Yes. So it's reduced sediment loss from the disturbance of beds and banks of water bodies and reduced damage to the bank and stream habitat.
Yes.
And Ms. MacArthur's evidence is that setbacks also provide a very important function for attenuating and filtering sediment that comes off the land.
Yes.
And both her and Dr. Daniel for Fish and Game refer to a study done by Michael Pingram and others that is Waikato specific and looked at the relative importance of key contaminant stressors in the Waikato in terms of ecosystem health parameters.
Yes.
And the conclusion of that study was that improving the management of sediment, riparian zones and in-stream habitat is most likely to enhance overall biological condition across the region, highlighting the need to extend policy development and implementation beyond a singular focus on water quality if ecosystem health objectives are to be met. So first of all, are you familiar with the study?
I'm not familiar with the study, no.
So you could you speak to or have you read the evidence on the importance of controlling sediment for achieving ecosystem health targets?
I'd certainly accept that, yes.
And Ms. MacArthur has done a literature review on at what point your riparian margin would start to have diminishing returns in terms of sediment attenuation and filtration. Have you looked at that?
I've read it, I don't remember the details.
And although the regional plan doesn't require riparian planting within setback areas,
yeah,
it will allow rank grasses to establish that will provide for that function, and that's simply something that it's a key thing I put to you for considering setback distances.
Yes, I can accept that.
with respect to overseer, Ms. Carruthers asked you some questions about this, so I won't repeat that. First of all, do you know if the Waikato Regional Council has taken up the Ministry for the Environment's offer to assist with considering and comparing different models that may be used in a regulatory context?
Not to my knowledge. I haven't heard that that's occurring. I know the offer's made.
So that's occurring?
I don't know if that's actively being considered at the moment.
And Mr. Matheson raised with you some of the farming evidence, and it's Mr. Newman's evidence. That open country dairy farmers, and there's 268 farms in the Panchang area, are not as familiar with the frontier and nitrogen risk scorecard.
Yes.
And use an overseer portal.
Yes.
And Mr. Newman's evidence is that he couldn't support a tool that he says sees Baldwin dairy as high risk than the existing tools that he knows and understands, say Baldwin dairy is moderate risk. And where does that leave you with Beef and Lamb's request for having two different tolls, Beef and Lamb and Federated Farmers? I assume you're in the same position, that you consider it unwieldy to have two different tolls, and you're in the same position in regard to the dairy EMIS scorecard.
Yes, that's right. It's not a matter of being unwieldy. It's a matter of trying to avoid gaming by having two different tools that can give you two different answers and end up with two different rules depending on which tool you use. It's just a fundamental problem I have with that from a policy planning position. I understand that there are many farmers that don't use the nitrogen risk scorecard, and yes, we're going to have to work with those farmers to help them to understand the scorecard and how it's used, and there's a lot of work to be done there. I know a lot of farmers won't like to use it, but if they're currently using it, obviously I understand those problems. At the end of the day, it is going to be a portal where they need to put in that information, which is relatively simple information, my understanding, in order to generate their number, their nitrogen risk card, scorecard number, to determine which rule they fit into. I understand it's not that big a process once you have the data.
Yes. All right, thank you. Just moving. I've only got a couple more questions, so do you want
to... No, if you've only got a couple, then I think we might try and finish your cross-examination and then take a break.
Thank you, sir. Now, with the Schedule C setbacks, previously the setback distance was to be effectively a mandatory requirement, but now you're proposing that a certifier can sign off a different setback if they consider the measures in the proposed farm environment plan will effectively prevent or minimise the risk to the water body from stock?
It's an interesting question. That's not how I've read it. I've read it that if you're required to have a fence, then it needs to meet those specified setbacks. But if you can't fence, the idea was you have a certified farm plan that shows how the farm will be managed without that fencing in those paddocks that will still achieve those three outcomes that are listed. That's the way I've interpreted that.
Thank you. I hope that's a much better way of putting it. There's going to be, and I think you've acknowledged it, a big issue is between fairness between farmers and individual farmers, with one farmer looking over the fence to see what their neighbour might be doing.
Yes, no, it wasn't me, that was Mr. Broxall.
Oh, sorry.
Concerned about that. Right. Yes, I mean, I agree, it's an important thing.
And do you consider that this provision, without tightening it up and making it a little bit more objective, may contribute to allegations of unfairness or that particular issue of ensuring that everybody is treated the same?
It may lead some farmers to feel that they are trying to do a lot more defence their farm when others aren't. It may lead to some of that, but I still think it's a practical way of recognising the differences in farms, different sort of places where farms have got to. I mean, when we're up with Mr. Berry's farm, he was kind of making the point that some farmers are a lot further down the track at the moment in terms of fencing their streams than others. And so, you know, there are so many different factors to be taken into account as to sort of what you do now, what's your current expectation through a farm environment plan to reduce discharges. So it is difficult to compare farms side by side because they have such different histories, they're at different places along the way. But, I mean, you're right, there is potential for that kind of comparison.
Thank you. Those are my questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Ms. Warrenby. Mr. Trebilko, you're still on the cross.